The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Today we're going to, well, coming up in the second segment, we're going to talk about the subject of toughness. Of course, there's lots of spiritual analogies and parallels to make on the subject of being tough. We're right in the midst of a busy PYC or a Philadelphia youth camp here on the Edmond campus. Teenagers coming from all over the world, and they have to endure a fair bit of trial and test, particularly out in the hot Oklahoma summer sun. Yesterday, I mentioned on the program the visit to the new G450, the open house, so to speak, down at the hangar at the Oklahoma City Airport. Hundreds of people. You add up all the campers and workers, and then the employees as well. Hundreds of people yesterday in and out of that that new aircraft that God has given to his work. And I noticed even the theme that Wayne Turgeon established for this particular youth camp, live right and take flight. Live right and take off or take flight. And yesterday we talked about the work, God's work taking off. God's work taking flight. We went through that that passage in Amos 9 where it says that God will raise up his ruins and build it as in the days of old. Build it just like during the days of Herbert W. Armstrong. It's going to be an exact replica of the way it was in the days of old. And so that's why if you look back at the history, all the coworker letters that Mr. Armstrong wrote, the autobiography, 900 pages of history there. That's why as you look back at that work, I mean, you get a vivid picture of where this work is headed. Live right, take flight, take off. Take off with God. It says in verse 12, I didn't read this yesterday, but Amos 9 verse 12 says, that they may possess the remnant of Edom, and of all the heathen which are called by my name, says the Eternal that does this. In his booklet, that prophet, my father wrote, if you're going to build this tabernacle as in the days of old, you would have to have the books and the booklets that you once had. That must include Mystery of the Ages and Mr. Armstrong's other books and booklets, like the autobiography, like Incredible Human Potential, The Missing Dimension in Sex. I mean, all of that has happened. Of course, it's amazing, too, to see God raising up his house, Armstrong Auditorium, and now providing the church with this awesome tool, the Gulfstream 450. But what a miracle it was to obtain all of that literature, all of Mr. Armstrong's writings, all the significant writings of Herbert Armstrong back in 2003. I mean, that was 14 years ago. What a miracle. I went through a coworker letter yesterday, Mr. Armstrong talking about all of these massive doors that were swinging open for the work in the late 60s and early 1970s. Massive doors. Let me just read to you another coworker letter. This is from 1974. The one yesterday, you'll remember, he talked about these coincidences, or are they coincidences? From 1974, he says, after 40 years, God has performed an astounding, tremendous miracle. He has opened unheard of doors. He has given me astonishing favor. With the top heads of state of nation after nation after nation around the world. He says this is being followed up by testimonial dinners sponsored by high-ranking cabinet members or others high in governments of nations. It says further on about one of these dinners, this public appearance campaign. He says this is then followed by a public appearance campaign. High government officials assume the responsibility of getting out thousands of highest and upper class people, the top substantial people of that country. Well, he talks about some of the speeches, some of the messages he delivered to those audiences. Further on, it says, all of this is an example of how the living Christ actually and literally guides and himself directs this work. It cannot be and is not a static work on a constant, unchanging routine. It sometimes requires change, new ideas, ways, and methods. It doesn't remain static. It continually grows. We have to continually take flight. We have to keep moving forward, keep producing growth, keep serving God. And along the way, we have to expect a certain amount of miracles, astonishing miracles from God to do this work. I mean, today we only have a scattered remnant from all over the world, but just a small group supporting this worldwide work, the message going out, all the literature being distributed, the message going out over TV and radio, on the websites. There's just a few supporting this work, and yet look at the work. Look at what God continues to give to us, the establishment of His college in 2001, the court case victory in 2003, the first group of graduates from AC in 2006, the Jerusalem dig in 2006, 2007, 2008, breaking ground on the house of God in 2008, the grand opening of God's house in 2010, all of those excavations on the Ophel in 2012 and 13. And then the purchase of Edstone in 2014. The opening of another campus in 2015. The starting of KPCG in 2015. And then the purchase of the Gulfstream 450 in 2017. Live right and take flight. Keep taking off. Keep growing. Going back to this coworker letter from 1974, here again, we're just here to build up an exact replica of what it was in the days of old. The same work. God's work. You look back into the Old Testament and see that after Elijah was taken away, I mean, the faithful remnant, they were asking, where is the God of Elijah? That's who we're looking for. We want to obey and serve the same God that Elijah served. And that's what God's work is doing today, following in the footsteps of the end time Elijah. Following in those footsteps. And here you see the same work. God's building it up as in the days of old. That comes right out of your Bible, Amos 9, verses 11 and 12. In 1974, Mr. Armstrong wrote, this new dimension, now getting the message into the great mass population Gentile countries, is something that could not have been done even 7 to 10 years ago. Even if Christ had opened these doors, we did not yet have the facilities and resources to follow through on it then. It's amazing how right timing, he says, it's amazing how right timing has played such an important part in God's work, and proof that He directed the timing. I mean, God's behind it all. We have to be patient sometimes and wait on God. But the timing, the pieces that He provides, the tools, the instruments that he gives to do the work, it's God's work. He's the one orchestrating it all. That's what's uppermost in his mind, finishing this work. That leads right into the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. It says here, in the mind of God, this is the most important activity on earth. It is his activity, the work he is doing through us. See, is the work of God the most important activity on earth in your mind? You go down to Oklahoma City, the airport, and step inside that aircraft. I mean, that's God's aircraft for God's work. This is God's college. That literature we obtained in 2003, that's God's material. That's God's truth. That's God's truth as he inspired Herbert Armstrong to write it. It says here in this 1974 letter, what a transcendent commission. What an awesome transcendent commission this is, Mr. Armstrong says, repeating himself. What a commission that God's given to this church. He wrote that in 1974, Mr. Armstrong did. And that was when the church, by the way, was turning liberal. They were watering down the truth. Those ministers at headquarters and out in the field, as Mr. Armstrong was traveling the world on God's aircraft, meeting with kings and prime ministers, giving those testimonial dinners, the public appearance campaigns, all of that, the public speaking. And so many of God's people were turning lukewarm spiritually. The most important activity on earth was no longer God's work. The Laodiceans, as I said yesterday, well, they're caught up in riches, physical riches and wealth, material things. They've gone to sleep spiritually. You think of that statement, in the mind of God, this is the most important activity on earth. This is uppermost in God's mind. What is going on in the mind of God? What's the most important activity on this earth in God's view? That's the perspective that we want. I mean, we want to think like God. We want to have the vision of God. It says in the Proverbs, without vision, we'll perish. We have to see what God sees when we look at this world. We have to see what God sees when we look at this work, when we look at all of the instruments that God gives to us to do the work, that they may possess the remnant of Edom. That remnant, well, if we're going to build it up like in the days of old, like my father said, that must mean we're going to have all the literature. And sure enough, God gave it to us. If we're going to build it up as in the days of old, that must mean we're going to have a college to support the work. That must mean that we're going to have a house for God. That must mean that we're going to have all of these operations to further the work. And even now, an aircraft. What a transcendent commission. Here was Herbert Armstrong, God's servant. 1974, what would he have been? That was 12 years before he died. So he's in his early 80s there. He's in his early 80s in 1974. And in case you didn't know the history, he went on to do the greatest work of his life in those following 12 years. It didn't matter that he was in his 80s, that he was approaching his 90s. Look at the work that God did through him. That's because it's God's work. Revelation 10 talks about the time of no more delay. I read that yesterday. When Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, I mean, the pace of world events, it certainly accelerated, and dramatically so, as we've now seen the emergence of the kings of the North and South. I saw an exchange on Fox News. It was a clip from it last night. The back and forth over the disaster in Iraq and then now Syria. and those that were cheerleading America's efforts in 2003 to remove Saddam Hussein. It was such a massive showing of force. But of course, now you have these commentators, 14 years on, they're saying, well, it didn't work out so well. I mean, we ended up just handing it over to Iran. And it made me think about all that we were writing long before 2003. Long before the Saddam Hussein regime was toppled. We were writing back in the mid-1990s about Iran's takeover of Iraq. Because we had God's perspective on the news. We had God's prophetic insight. The pace of world events, what an acceleration. Verse 7 says, this is Revelation 10, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, it should read, the mystery of God should be finished. As he has declared to his servants the prophets, time is short. We've got to finish this work. The work has to be finished before the seventh trumpet sounds. We've got to fulfill God's work, God's will, finish this commission. Verse 11 says, and he said unto me, you must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. Mr. Armstrong wanted Mystery of the Ages to go out to the largest audience possible. Well, he died and the Takachas cut that work short, and they buried Mystery of the Ages. They burned copies. And they said later they had a Christian duty to keep Mystery of the Ages and other writings of Herbert Armstrong out of circulation. And so God just said, no, I'm not going to let that happen. I'm going to give those vessels to my church doing my work so that they can distribute the truth of God. God raised up another work to finish the job that Mr. Armstrong started. God raised up the ruins. God said, I'm going to build it just like in the days of old. In my father's book, the Royal Book of Revelation, he said, when Mr. Armstrong said he wanted to get Mystery of the Ages to the largest audience possible, that really was a commission for God's Philadelphia church today. I mean, that's a commission for you and me. If you're an enthusiastic supporter of God's church and work today, if the work of God is the most important activity on earth in your mind, then here's what you're concerned about doing and finishing and contributing to. Verse 1 of the next chapter, Revelation 11, it says, and there was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. No chapter break here. There shouldn't be one. It just flows right into this. This measuring the temple or the church. Warning the church. Warning the ministry of the Worldwide Church of God. Verse 2 says, but the court which is without the temple leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. So some of the brethren of God, God's family, They can't be reached with this message. Well, you can read the rest of chapter 11 there, but look at what it culminates in. Verse 14, the second woe is past, and behold, the third woe comes quickly. And the seventh angel sounded. Here it is, verse 15. And there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. Our God-given commission, this God-commissioned work, actually culminates in this, the greatest event in the history of the universe. When the kingdoms of this world, when the nations of this world become God's nations, the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. And he shall reign forever. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. If the church came into existence as an instrumentality for getting people saved, then by what means did God try to save people prior to Christ's founding of the church? Jesus did not appear until 4,000 years after Adam and the original sin. If God is and has been trying to convert the world, what means did he use during that 4,000 years between Adam and Christ? Few people in the traditional Christian world have ever stopped to even consider these questions. To nearly everyone on earth, the very existence of the church is a great mystery. The biblical facts of the church's origin and its purpose for being are clearly revealed in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, Mystery of the Ages. Request your complimentary copy today. It's offered free of charge, at no cost or obligation to you. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Yesterday I mentioned the comment that's in my father's book, Malachi's Message to God's Church Today, where he talked about the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong and how it wasn't just a history book about Mr. Armstrong. It's really a history book about the growth and the development of the Philadelphia era of God's church. It's the history of our work. This activity that is uppermost in God's mind. In the mind of God, this is the most important activity on earth. God's work. God's work. Now, if that's uppermost in God's mind, finishing this work, then what is uppermost in Satan's mind, our adversary's mind? What is it that Satan wants to stop or slow down the most? What is it that the devil wants to prevent us or you from accomplishing most? Well, just knowing what it is that is uppermost in God's mind, that tells you right there what it is we're going to be fighting against. All the obstacles that we're going to be going up against. In the autobiography, Mr. Armstrong said this on page 756. He said, "Now, of course, there have been problems, obstacles, oppositions, persecutions, setbacks. It hasn't been easy. God doesn't make it easy to go his way. Jesus Christ taught us to count the cost. We have to learn that God does most things with us and through us as his instruments. He only does for us what we are utterly unable to do ourselves. We have had to fight the way through. We've had to fight our way through. We've had to think, to apply ourselves energetically, to drive ourselves onto the limit of our capacity." He says, "In this sense, God has let us do it. He merely directed us, but he also empowered us where necessary and brought about circumstances." See, God does miraculously intervene where we are utterly unable to do it ourselves. And he also tests us and tries us and prods us to go the straight and narrow and difficult way. You read through the autobiography and all of the headaches that Herbert Armstrong encountered, the $30,000 headache, he called it. he said at one point when he was working to raise up the college that one night he almost snapped. And that he asked God if he'd just let him die in the middle of the night. That was when Herbert Armstrong was in his 50s. I told you in the first segment about things he was doing in his 80s and 90s even. Well, back in his 50s, it was hard. There was a tremendous amount of stress and pressure that he was facing every day, and it was almost unbearable. Well, in that particular case, he got up the next morning and he repented before God and he soldiered on. God was really teaching him a lot about faith, about what it means to relax in faith, about what it means to be tough, spiritually tough, and to endure and to wait patiently on God. To stay strong, even in the midst of adversity. To lay those burdens, those heavy burdens, on the shoulders of Jesus Christ. It says in the autobiography, this lesson of faith does not come easily. Sometimes it's achieved only through punishing experience. We need to learn that God does not do all things for us. He does many things in and through us. We have to do our part. But there are some things that we can't do, he says, and which we must rely on him to do wholly for us. It takes wisdom to know which is which. It takes wisdom to know when to push through and to fight with God's help and direction, and when to wait on God and to trust him entirely for his timely intervention. Cast those burdens on Christ, he said. I have a clip here from an old radio broadcast where he's talking about some of the troubles and trials and struggles that he endured through in service to God. This is clip one.
But now getting back to this, we do all have our troubles. Life is made that way, and it's all for a purpose. The Creator designed that we should have these things to buck up against. He didn't make life easy. But let me tell you something I've learned, my friends. I've lived. There are very few of you listening to me that have ever lived as much as I have lived. And when I say I have lived, if you really have, you'll know I mean something else. I've known what suffering is. I've had to suffer, too, and I've learned a lot by the things I've suffered. I've had to learn a lot of lessons in my lifetime. And here's one of the lessons that I have learned. And that is that the Almighty Creator set laws in motion, forces, energies, laws. Your physicist knows about some of these laws. Your chemist knows something about them. Now there are other laws that he knows nothing about. There are spiritual laws that he knows nothing about. And those laws affect your life. And those laws were made for your good, not for your harm. They weren't made to punish you. They weren't made to harm you. But they will punish you and they will harm you if you go against them. If you utilize them, if you use them in the right manner and the right way, those laws will bring you happiness. And while they're bringing you happiness, you're going to be the means of bringing other people happiness along with those same laws. And I have learned this, that life can be very beautiful and very happy. Now, I don't believe it's possible for anyone to live and get through life without problems and without troubles and without things that would literally make the average person's hair stand on end, that are just going to occasionally throw fright and fear into your mind unless you have learned that lesson of absolute faith. That is your guarantee against it, and will throw out the fear.
That's Herbert Armstrong from one of his old radio programs talking about just the purpose of this life and how that God meant for us to face adversity. He designed it so that we would have things to buck up against. He didn't make life easy. It's the straight and narrow way for the Christian. And so in counting the cost, we have to accept the fact that we're going to face this kind of trouble, problems and trials, and learn to trust God with relaxed faith and learn to believe his promises. Like in 1 Corinthians 10, where it says, there is no temptation taken you, but such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. God knows what we can handle. God will always provide the way of escape. And as Mr. Armstrong was saying there, if you stay with God and those spiritual laws, there are blessings that will follow. But it's hard to fight for God. My father makes the point in his writings that offensive warfare is, it's three or four times harder than just a defensive strategy. He wrote in his book, How to Be an Overcomer, there's a lot of stress in war. People have broken down from that stress. But did you know that real fighters almost never get stressed out? We have to be real fighters for God. There's a proverb that says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. You don't have the strength. You don't have the faith. If you wilt under just a little bit of pressure. As I say, I mean, this is something that we really are working to try to teach our young people. Our boys in particular, when you talk about even physical toughness, that's a challenge for any parent in God's church as you try to find the balance between protecting them, sheltering them, keeping them away from as many influences, the evil influences of this world and of the devil, while at the same time teaching our children to be strong and to be able to resist against the devil's pull. I know even in the case of my own son coming into this summer, I knew it was going to be a busy summer. He has the blessed opportunity to go to two youth camps, one here in Edmond, the other one in Edstone. I know those are valuable experiences. But with as busy as he is through the school year with academics and then dance, piano and such, I know that my wife and I were discussing and praying that God would just give him more opportunities to be tougher and to experience more masculine things as he develops into a young man, a strong young man. That's what we're aiming for. And already, I mean, there's certain disadvantages to the schedule that we keep. I've mentioned it before on the radio. A lack of practical work experience, for example. But already, as we've tried to bring God into it, we've seen some opportunities that he's given to that teen, and he'll do it for all of our teens. We have to do our part and then trust that God will do his and make it a partnership and prepare these youths, boys and girls, prepare them for the Christian walk, which is not an easy one. It's right through the narrow gate. It's right along this long and difficult and bumpy road. And only a few, Jesus said, are willing to finish the journey. Only a few are willing to stay the course, to fight for God, to fight against the pulls of the flesh. Mr. Armstrong wrote this. He said, God has not intended our Christian lives and his service to run smooth and easy with no problems, no concerns. God intended, ordained even, that we should be confronted with continual problems, difficulties, troubles, that we should have to make constant sacrifices, learning to give up our own ways and wants. That's something to think about for you and me as adults. But think about it too, if you happen to have teenagers. Are they being confronted with problems and difficulties and troubles? Are they learning to overcome? Are they building that kind of spiritual toughness into their lives? Are they able to stand up against the pulls of the flesh? It says in James 1, verse 2, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith works patience." This is a good thing, to be tried and tested. That's not something we want to protect our young people from and then hand them over to the college when they're 18 after having really never been tried and tested, after never really having to overcome problems or difficulties or troubles. It's a challenge. I know it's a challenge. I have children. I'm just saying, bring God into it and prepare them for the Christian walk. Prepare them for this way of life. In the Good News magazine, this is from July of 1967, it says, "God has ordained that this life will not be an easy life for a very good reason. He knows that if we have no severe trials and tests, then we become spiritually soft and flabby." See, we want to avoid that, whether physical or spiritual. Flabbiness, softness. Read 1 Corinthians 6, 9 and 10 sometime. With respect to that word soft, there's a word over there in 1 Corinthians 6, effeminate. It says further here in this Good News piece, "God Almighty knows that we need problems, temptations, trials, necessities, weaknesses, persecutions, and afflictions to stir us to action, to stir us up enough to overcome our spiritual lethargy. He knows that we need to have continual trials, tribulations, and persecutions in order to toughen us up spiritually, in order to show us how weak and helpless we are, so that we will always look to Him and rely on Him for everything." How tough are we spiritually? Can we toughen up more? Can our children toughen up more? Can we go to God and acknowledge how weak and helpless we really and truly are, and then cry out to Him for strength and power? God wants us to be tougher. That's what He needs in His family. He wants for us to be children who are strong. Be strong in the Lord. That's what Paul wrote. Be strong in the Lord. Go to God for that strength, that toughness, that spiritual vitality, that energy, that drive, that discipline. 1 Samuel chapter 17. Let's look at this example. David and Goliath, one of the best known accounts in the Bible. 1 Samuel 17, and we'll start in verse 20. It says here, "And David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper, and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the trench as the host was going forth to fight, and shouted for the battle." So here's a young man who really was eager to get out and to witness the battle and to help Israel in any way that he could. It says, "For Israel had the Philistines Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army, and David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. And he talked with them. As he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spoke according to the same words. And David heard them, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. These were not spiritually tough soldiers. They were fearful. They were afraid. And David was ashamed. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up, and it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel." All these great rewards were offered. It says, "And David spoke to the men that stood by him, saying, 'What shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? And who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?'" I mean, here's David, this lowly shepherd, stepping forward and saying, "Well, who does this giant think he is? Does he actually think he's going to stop God's work? Does he actually believe that he's going to slow down the most important activity on earth?" Verse 27 says, "And the people answered him after the manner, saying, 'So shall it be done to the man that kills him.'" And Eliab, well, you know the history here. David's brothers looked upon him with disdain, and they thought he was out there just because of his vanity, trying to get attention. And David said in verse 29, "Is there not a cause? Look, forget about me for a second. Here's this giant cursing the armies of God, and you're quaking in fear. You're running away from the challenge." Down in verse 34, it says, "And David said unto Saul, 'Your servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock, and I went out after him, and smote him, and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and smote him, and slew him.'" This is just a teenager. This is a remarkable teenager, I think. When you look at what he did there to protect those sheep, that's quite a lot of courage and toughness, whether you look at it spiritually or physically. Verse 39, "And David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed to go, for he had not proved it," the armor, that is. "And David said to Saul, 'I can't go with these, for I've not proved them.' And David put them off." He couldn't do it with all this armor, with this big sword and shield. What he was more familiar with was, of course, his sling and a few stones. And how many hours and hours and hours he had spent in his youth doing athletic things, hurling that sling. Verse 40 says, "And he took his staff in his hand, and he chose him five smooth stones out of the brook, and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a scrip. And his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine." Here comes the teenager. Here comes the teenager ready to slay a giant. Here comes a tough teen. Here comes a teen fit for battle. Verse 42, "And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy, and of a fair countenance." Well, this is just a weakling, the giant thought. But David was no weakling. David was a strong and robust fellow. David was fearless because he knew God backed him. Verse 43, It says here, and the Philistine said unto David, am I a dog that you come to me with staves or staves? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. And then said David to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. I'm representing God. I'm fulfilling God's will. I'm doing God's work. Verse 46 says, this day will the Lord deliver you into my hand, and I will smite you and take your head from you, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beast of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And verse 47 says, and all this assembly shall know that the Lord saves not with the sword and spear, for the battle is the Eternal's, and he will give you into our hands. See, it's not even really our battle, is it? We've got to be fearless. We've got to have courage. We've got to step forward and fight for God and do it in faith, knowing that it's God's battle. It's God's fight. What a combination. That's an unbeatable combination. A teenager with that kind of courage, with that kind of fearlessness, with that kind of faith, relaxed faith. It says in verse 48 that he ran toward the army. He ran out to meet the Philistine. He ran out to meet up with Goliath. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell upon his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him, and there was no sword in the hand of David. What a miraculous victory. And it didn't end there. You can look over at 2 Samuel in chapter 21 and read about how many other giants were slain by, not David, by David's men. I mean, we just saw where the entire army, they were quaking in fear. But David helped to completely turn it around for Israel. And soon there were an army of Davids. My father touched on this in a program. I think this was from 3 years ago. Why David fought. This is clip two.
The most beautiful ending in this chapter, or this story, let's say this event, was, you can read it, and you ought to read it, in 2 Samuel 21 and verse 15, where it says that, and shows how David taught his servants and all of those people to fight against the sons of Goliath. There still were giants around. And he taught these men that were under him to fight giants. They were tough people when they learned how to fight with faith and in faith for God and for David. Now, this is just remarkable and wonderfully inspiring when you think about it. It says in verse 22 of that chapter, these four were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David and the hand of his servants. David and his servants were taught to fight like David and slay the giants, and we all have giants to slay in our lives.
That's from my father's program 3 years ago, Why David Fought, his Key of David program. And you'll note there that he said on two times, I guess it was, that we have to be taught to fight this way. We have to be taught. We have to teach our children to fight this way. We have to teach our young boys to be gutsy and courageous like this, and to look to God in faith. We have to be fit for the battle, as it says in 1 Chronicles. We have to be mighty men of valor, as it also says in that same book my father wrote in the former prophets. We must learn to war and fight like these tough soldiers who had faith in God and who really loved each other. God is telling us he wants us to be tougher, my father says. God wants us to be tougher. We need to become warriors like Zadok and Benaiah and their sons. We can have their kind of courage because, like them, we have the unlimited power of God behind us. My father's also made the point in his writings that, you know, if we're just left to our own devices or to what comes natural, I mean, naturally, we're cowards. We're afraid. We're fearful. But God can turn that around for us. God must turn it around for us, just like David turned it around for the Israelites. Because in this battle that we're in, and Christianity is a battle, we have to fight the good fight of faith, as Paul said. We have to fight. We have to finish the course. We have to finish the marathon race. We have to be tough. God is saying he wants us to be tougher. And so look at 2 Timothy in particular, what Paul has to say in chapters 2 and 4 about not getting caught up in the ways of this world and learning to endure hardness like that good soldier of Christ. As I say, that's a challenge. As a parent, that's a challenge to teach these lessons, to reinforce these principles in the lives of our teens. But this is what God expects, and God expects it of us as parents and adults as well, to be spiritually tough, to get our lives, our minds, our activities, everything to where they're revolving around God, this most important activity on earth, God's work, to pour our hearts into the work. And then added to that, to just be tougher, as my father said there in the former prophets. God is telling us that he wants us to be tougher. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you tomorrow.